This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And with Thanksgiving officially in the rear view mirror, it is full on holiday music season. Love it or hate it, Christmas music is everywhere that you go. But have you ever asked yourself, what makes a song a Christmas song? Turns out there's more to it than just saying Santa or Jesus. We are visiting now with Dr. Michael Culleton. He is an associate professor of music at Concordia College, where he is also the director of choral activities, among other musical responsibilities. Dr. Culleton, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you. And Christmas music, yes. You know, and I spend a lot of time with Christmas music is June. So even with Thanksgiving in the rearview mirror, I've learned in my job at Concordia, it's a year-round adventure because we got to plan this Christmas concert.
You have the big Christmas concert coming up Friday and Saturday and Sunday Moorhead. And you can get details at concordiacollege.edu. And I'm guessing you're serious that planning for the Christmas concert starts in June?
Oh, absolutely.
Or maybe December 26th.
That's what it is. It's kind of when I finish up the Christmas concerts at Concordia, then we still have like weeks to go until Christmas time. And so I'm hearing Christmas music. I'm hearing it on the radio. I'm watching specials on television. And really, I'm starting to plan the next Christmas concert in the days, nay, minutes after the Christmas concert wraps up. And really, a lot of the planning is March and April and May so that I can meet with our mural designer in June.
Oh my gosh.
So he's drawing Christmas, June and July. And then, we put this together all throughout the fall at Concordia, and then it hits December, and then repeat that cycle all over again. So lots of fun.
And you still love Christmas music?
Oh, I love Christmas music. You know, there was a time back in 2000, I was just finishing my master's degree at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So it's July, it's Tucson, and one of the greatest gigs of my life was singing background vocals on a Linda Ronstadt Christmas CD. And so we would record Lohal Rose Air Blooming, leave the studio, get into the Chrysler Sebring convertible.
And it's 107 degrees in the desert.
So I have lived with Christmas music calendar round, year round, for many, many years. But and that was just me dropping Linda Ronstadt's name right there.
Yeah,
I'll try not to drop too many names. You know. But that was a real pleasure, actually. Recording a wide variety of Christmas music. In fact, what I remember about that Christmas CD was it was so eclectic. It had things that we would know very well, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. It had a Renaissance Spanish piece called O Magnum Mysterium. And then it had a jazz group from L.A. coming in on tracks like Joni Mitchell's River. And so it talk about eclectic and wondering what makes Christmas music Christmas music. I think Linda Ronstadt was trying to figure that out, too. And she was kind of doing a lot of the music that she loved from all sorts of different aspects of her life onto one CD.
So. Well, what to you makes a song a Christmas song?
Oh, well, for me, you hinted at the two big ones, of course, coming into the show today. And
yeah, we've got religion and commercialism.
You got it. Yeah, we've got them. And there's no connection between those two ever. But yes, it's the songs of the season, of course, in the Christian background, that season of Christ's birth. In the secular time, we've got the music of Santa Claus, winter, special reindeer with fun, you know,
noses.
And and then, of course, holiday traditions from all around the world come into play at the same time of the year. We think of the Jewish tradition of Hanukkah and Kwanzaa that our children have been learning more and more about for the last, more than a decade, I suspect, in the schools. So, I think what makes a song a Christmas song? Somewhere there's a deep connection. You know, we've known for a long time that music connects in the brain at a level that befuddles doctors and scientists when they are dealing with patients who suffer from memory loss, for example. But there's such connections to music that oftentimes, and in a lot of larger communities, you'll find that there are choirs for memory care patients. And though they may not remember their family members' names, they remember the words of music that they grew up listening to.
I can sing. I've got the joy, 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 joy in my heart in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish.
Oh, yes.
So what is going on there? I don't know.
Yeah, I can match you. We were doing Alegría, Alegría, Alegría this year with the Concordia Choir at the Christmas concert. And, you know, I think all of our students kind of say, you know, deep down, I know this song.
Mm.
I know this song from somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think the other fun thing, though, in this part of the country is that along with religion and along with Santa Claus, we have the weather that for some reason resonates with us. Like people sing Frosty the Snowman down in Tucson, Arizona. I know that.
Oh, yeah.
But like they've ever seen a snowman or made a snowman.
Right.
But our memories can be tied to going out and making the snowman and trying to make it look like Frosty the Snowman. So, I mean, in so many ways in our lives, we resonate with these carols because of experience with them, whether it's singing them in the Sunday school choir or your elementary school choir performance or hearing them on the radio stations all throughout the holiday season. Do we remember the first time we heard I Saw Mama Kissing Santa Claus? I don't remember the first time, but I know I've heard that song a ton.
Well, let's hear it right now by the Jackson 5. All right. How old were you when you realized that Santa Claus was just your dad?
Oh, yeah. I remember that talk. You know, it was only the second most awkward talk that I ever remember my parents sitting me down for. But we were in the situation, I have a twin brother, and we were in the situation where, but we had a younger sibling, so this was very privileged information, which was also like the other conversation, privileged information. You
yeah,
know?
Right. And, do not share.
Do not share.
Because you will not translate that properly.
You know, I'm going to say like third or fourth grade, if I remember right, third or fourth grade. And then you start connecting all sorts of other dots about, oh, and you left us dollars for our teeth.
Okay. Oh, right. And there's that.
All of those things.
Yeah.
But, oh, yes.
Oh, my kid busted me. She saw the alarm on my phone of put money under the pillow for Addie's tooth. So,
oh, boy.
Whatever. But let's talk about that song. Obviously, a very secular song.
Yep.
First of all, just Michael Jackson was, I mean, rest in peace.
Yep.
He was a child in the Jackson 5.
Right.
And just the ability to carry a song like that as someone who is directing and coaching young performers. How do you approach talent and try to get them to have this emotion when it's something that they maybe are not going to understand?
Yeah. It's a little bit like theater, I suppose, in that you really have to start with, so what's the character we're going for? And Michael Jackson, in that particular clip, he was a storyteller. And really having to tell the story, whether you're in it to win it or not on it, really getting behind the words and telling the story and trying to connect with just the idea that people for decades of their lives have resonated with that tune and trying to bring them along with that story. And frankly, in a case like that song, the absurdity of the whole situation and kind of the naivete of the situation of you did not see your daddy kissing your mommy at that moment. You saw mommy kissing Santa Claus and oh, the horror. But wait, if she could be with anybody except my dad, maybe Santa would be a great person. You know,
that's some good, solid child reasoning. I'm actually surprised I haven't thought that.
Well, yeah. And so, finding the fun character about these kinds of pieces. There's another song that really captures the imagination. I've done it many times over the years at little family holiday concerts that I've led at public libraries where it was music for all ages. And kind of the vision of it's a marshmallow world in the winter. And this was a song I came across because of the great treasure that sits on our piano at home almost year-round, and I even brought it into the studio today, as you see, the Reader's Digest Christmas Songbook. Mm. And, you know, as I'm paging through the songbook years and years ago, for the first time, I had been given this as a gift from a family friend, and I came across this song called It's a Marshmallow World, and I thought, oh, this is such a fun piece of music. It was new to me, but I'll tell you what happened was now I hear it on advertising all throughout the holiday season, and I heard it on a Christmas commercial this past weekend.
All right. And, well, let's hear it right now by none other than Dean Martin.
Oh.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's time for play. It's a whipped cream day. I wait for it the whole year round. Those are marshmallow clouds being friendly in the arms of the evergreen trees. And the sun is red like a pumpkin head. It's shining so your nose won't freeze. Oh, the world is your snowball. See how it grows. That's how it goes. Whenever it snows, the world is your snowball just for a song. Get out and roll it along.
That's a version of It's a Marshmallow World performed by Dean Martin. We are visiting today with Concordia's Dr. Michael Culleton about what makes music Christmas music. And I want to talk about this sort of crooner approach because,
man,
you can just hear the brandy swirling in the snifter when
Absolutely.
He is singing, right?
And you can see the coat he's wearing. And yeah, you can just come. But that Dean Martin, what a legendary crooner, you know, and the very first entrance, it's a marshmallow, that little slide up into it. You know,
I just sound drunk when I do that.
Well, and Dean Martin, this is take five probably at least on that recording. But what I love about songs like Marshmallow World and some of these very secular Christmas season pieces, it's just the imagery that comes over. And I think it's one of the reasons we connect with the pieces, because when he's saying, when the snow comes to cover the ground, you know, here we sit waiting for that. We know we're like anticipating the fact that, sometime it's going to snow. Now, I'm always okay if it's after the Concordia Christmas concerts. I don't need snow to define my experiences this early in December and November. But we see when the snow comes to cover the ground on the lyric sheet, and I go, it's time for play. It's a whipped cream day. And I remember as a kid, we'd go out and toss the whipped cream at each other out in the front yard there in the snowfall, building our forts and getting our sleds out. And this whole song just harkens back to those memories that we all have of growing up at the Christmas season. The world is your snowball. See how it grows. And sometimes when I'm not ready for the snow to be in the yard, I think – I'm just going to go make a bunch of big snowballs and basically pick up the snow in the yard anyway.
But, yeah. Well, that's such an amazing line. The world is your snowball. See how it grows.
Yeah.
And, like, really just transports you back into that childhood mentality of anything is possible.
Yeah. And it's a yum, yummy world made for sweethearts and that little sense of romance that could be in the air at that same time. And now you're remembering those times you're out ice skating with hot chocolate. And it really taps into those core memories that now I think about core memories like that Disney Pixar movie Inside Out, those fun things that we know we don't want to let go of in our subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And so this song triggers a lot of those for me. It's been a favorite of mine for a long time. And I know that when you sing it for young people, they might not even have been in that place long enough where they will connect with these words, but it's kind of for the parents in the room that moment.
The
imagery is fun for the students and for the children, but for the parents, they're relating on a whole different level. And I think that's true with a lot of these types of pieces, like I Saw Mama Kissing Santa Claus. Parents will connect at a high level, children at a fun low level.
Is that unique to Christmas music?
Oh, no, and nor to music in general, right? We can go see a movie with mature themes at one level, but also the same themes at a level that children can just enjoy for the storytelling that it represents. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's unique to music, but I think that music helps us connect the synapses in the brain and relate the stories in a more deep, meaningful manner.
Hmm. Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about the difference between a song and a composition. Songs have words, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but compositions usually don't. Is that
right?
Correct?
Yep. Songs, lyrics implied. I think about orchestral music, you know, no lyrics, but they can still tell stories.
Well, yeah. I want to talk to you about now, because you work with choir students, but you also are working with songs that are instrumental.
Yep.
So from the emotional standpoint, I mean, you talked about getting this kid to pretend to actually think they're seeing mom kissing Santa Claus and like what would that mean? Mm-hmm. But when there aren't words to connect to, what is your process for bringing out that emotion?
You know, when there are not words that tie us to a specific story or even perhaps a particular memory, orchestral music allows us instead to think what we want to think about the music. There's not necessarily a prescription for it. Mm. You know, every year we do an orchestral prelude at the Christmas concerts at Concordia. And it's really to kind of set the mood, if you will, for the concert that is to come, and almost to gather the listeners into a zen place of being one with the audience as we enter into this Christmas season and the Christmas concert, the Christmas journey. But what I love about orchestral music is it can mean something different to me every time I listen to it, and words aren't in the way to necessarily guide me to a specific path. Our orchestral prelude this year at the concert is from Edward Elgar's beautiful Enigma Variations. It's called Nimrod from the Enigma Variations.
That feels like a word I'll use at Christmas.
Nimrod. Not necessarily a Christmas tune, and by necessarily I mean in any way, but the music is so evocative, and it's almost like it halts the time for that 3.5 minutes or so. It just halts, and it starts very gentle. Listeners can kind of start to find a focus, and they can go into whatever place they want to go to as they think about the concert to come, the season that we're celebrating, what their surroundings, the beautiful mural in front of them, the lights coming down. There are other orchestral classics that are tied to the Christmas season, and perhaps the most famous is the Tchaikovsky Nutcracker Ballet Suite, and you hear some of those movements, and you are just immediately transported back to that seat that you were in watching the ballet, and maybe it's the only ballet you've ever seen in your life, but you see the children dancing around the tree and the nutcracker coming to life, and there are no words to guide that story, but instead a dance ballet presentation to help move it along. Yeah, I love orchestral music. I really, for a choir guy, I really connect a lot with the story behind orchestral music, but I think what I love most about it is that it can mean something different every time I listen to it. And there's no prescribed lyric or anything like that. So I think orchestral music, very important part of our season together. And, of course, symphony orchestras all around the world celebrating the season with medleys of familiar tunes, just without the lyrics.
We're visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton. He is the Paul J. and Eleanor Christensen Chair of Choral Music at Concordia College. The upcoming famous Concordia Christmas concert is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There's also going to be a video version available online later. You can go to concordiachristmas.com for more details. Michael, I just called you the chair of choral music. Mm-hmm. I've heard this part of the country referred to as the choral belt.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the significance of this region and its relationship to choral music?
Yeah, it's really a strong connection here. Back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a man named Efmelius Christiansen came from Norway to study music in Minnesota, and he settled at St. Olaf College, where for many years he conducted the St. Olaf Choir. Now, what he brought to America was a European-based choral approach, and specifically kind of a Norwegian and Germanic approach to choral music making, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, a cappella. This was primarily music sung without piano or without instruments. And, you know, then it's just kind of like the seeds were sown. The students of Efmelius Christiansen went on to lead major programs. His two sons, Olaf Christiansen and Paul J. Christiansen, also became very famous in Minnesota. Olaf Christiansen conducted at St. Olaf College after his father, Efmelius, retired. And Paul J. Christiansen came to Concordia College and conducted the Concordia Choir for 50 years. Wow. And so both Olaf Christiansen and Paul J. Christiansen continue to have their music students go out, become teachers at the high school level, collegiate levels. The folks who followed in their footsteps, Ken Jennings at St. Olaf and Renee Clausen, my predecessor at Concordia College. Renee retired after 34 years of teaching the Concordia Choir. So for the last now 88 years, there have only been three of us who have conducted the Concordia Choir. And so I like to say that Paul J. conducted for 50 years, Renee conducted for 34 years. This is my fourth year. Or another way to look at it is we averaged 29 years apiece of leadership for this wonderful organization. But I think that it's because of Efmelius Christiansen coming, introducing this a cappella choral style in a new way to a new area. And then it was all of the students of all of these people that have come through and led these collegiate programs of Luther College. Weston Noble taught at Luther College for 57 years. The traditions are so longstanding. In a way, you know, it's a lot like Christmas music. This music gets in the bones and it becomes a part of our being. And at homecoming, we have hundreds of people come up and sing our final. We sing Beautiful Savior to end our concert programs every concert. And at homecoming, it's no surprise we have hundreds of people come and sing with us on the stage for that particular piece. So, yeah, choral country up here. This is the choral belt. There are certainly other great choral traditions around America, but this one is deeply rooted into the fabric of the music making of the singers throughout this Midwest. And really, it's because of good teaching, strong traditions, the legacy of these great schools. And not surprisingly, all of the schools, you know, that I've mentioned that are kind of part of the liberal arts Lutheran tradition in our region, they all celebrate Christmas with huge, beloved Christmas concerts. Yeah. So it's kind of like the combination of the Lutheran choral liberal arts tradition. By the way, you don't have to be Lutheran to sing in the Lutheran liberal arts choral tradition. But that's really the tradition from which we are anchored. And we combine that with the sacred Christmas tradition. And we all do these Christmas concerts that are beloved, well-known, aired on public television all around the country and supported by people all around the country. So, yeah, two very special traditions kind of coming together at this time of the year.
That sacred music tradition. We are visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton, and coming up, we are going to get more into the religious music of Christmas.
The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus heralds the season with its 46th annual Christmas concert, A Christmas Quilt, on Saturday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, December 10th at 4 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck. The concert showcases traditional carols like The First Noel and Hark the Herald Angels Sing to contemporary pieces like Let It Snow and Home for the Holidays. Special guest performances include the Mandan Middle School Swing Choir. The concerts are free and open to the public with a free will offering to support the chorus. More information at 701-400-7774 or on the Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus Facebook page.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are dedicating today's show to Christmas music and what makes a song Christmassy and why we have such deep emotional attachments or maybe reactions to Christmas music. I'm visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton. He is an associate professor of music at Concordia College, and he is also the director of choral activities and conductor director of the Concordia Choir, which has its big Concordia Christmas concert coming up this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And there will later be a video version available online. You can go to concordiacollege.edu for more details on the Concordia Christmas concert. And Michael, we spent the first half of the show talking a little bit more about the secular traditions of Christmas. But of course, this is a celebration for Christians around the world, the birth of Christ. And there is a great deal of, as you might expect, religious music
indeed
associated with that. Let's talk about what makes a song Christmassy from the perspective of the sacred.
Well, certainly the pieces that we come to know the most from the sacred side of things now are going to put us kind of in that place in the manger. I think about Away in a Manger. We're going to be zoomed into the story here for the birth of Jesus, the babe in the manger. And so these now we enter into a realm of songs that many church-going singers or Christmas music lovers will connect to because they've been singing since they were in their Sunday school choirs and doing the cute Sunday school shows, and they've been singing Away in a Manger and Silent Night and Joy to the World. And now we're into these carols. You hear the caroling groups singing all throughout the season. And if you're lucky to hear them, like the Moorhead Spud caroling group around town, I think they have like 40 gigs or something.
Oh, yeah, and they wear those costumes.
Oh, the costumes are great.
So cute.
And, you know, they're going to be singing a lot of those types of songs that tell of the specific story of the birth of Christ. And so for a lot of people, of course, there's the deep religious connection to these pieces. But I find that even those who don't participate on a regular basis in a church service, they still resonate with some of these pieces deeply, and as deeply perhaps as anything that they would resonate with. I mean, if they hear Silent Night being sung, whether it be with a choir of 300 singers and a big orchestra, or whether it be one person playing with the guitar. You know, it was originally thought that it was written for one singer and a guitar. And what a beautifully intimate feeling that is for Silent Night. And sometimes, of course, when we sing it at the Concordia Christmas concerts, there's not a whole lot of silent in it when you've got 300 people doing a rousing and moving version of it with 2,000 people singing along. But it tends to be one of those moments in our concert where I feel the most connection to the audience members, because they are singing from their feet, I say, you know, where their whole body is engaged in the singing of this piece. So it's certainly tied to the imagery of the season, even the story of, like, the angel Gabriel from heaven came. And we hear about when Mary first found out that she was going to give birth to the Son of God. And so there's lots of wonderful, beautiful imagery throughout all of those Christmas carols that connect on a very deep level. But one of the things that I love doing with the Concordia Christmas concert is finding the pillars of the story we're going to tell. Ours is the narrative of the birth of Christ. And so we have these narratives of the angels and the shepherds. And so we're going to, you know, certainly get your Hark the Herald Angels Sing type of a piece into the Christmas concert, as we do this year. We have the concert pieces where you're talking about the shepherds, or, as I mentioned, the babe in the manger, or the friendly beasts who gather around and witness the birth of Christ. And there are just so many pieces that I think people have resonated with for so long because they've sung them or they've heard them, but for so many years.
Well, let's take a listen to the 2016 version of Concordia Christmas Concerts version of Silent Night.
Thank you.
Michael, you used a great phrase called singing from your feet. Walk us through what it feels like to be in that room.
That's amazing. That's the third verse of Silent Night. That was arranged by my predecessor, Renee Clausen. There was a Christmas concert one year called Son of God Loves Pure Light, and that's why right before that lyric or during that lyric, there's a big slowdown. And, you know, what's not a silent thing is the rolled cymbal going on there. And but it really drew out that text of the theme. And what I love about that moment every year, we do that. That's one of our two traditional pieces on that program, is right before verse 3, everybody in the audience stands up. It says in the program, please stand as you are able. And they've been singing with us for verse 1 and 2, but they all know what's coming. That big slowdown and that big dramatic climactic moment of the music. And it always gives me goosebumps. And there are years where I'm too moved to even sing along with the people. And I find myself inhaling through my nose to dry the tear ducts a little bit, you know. And there was a particularly wonderful moment a couple of years ago where it was Renee's last Christmas concert. And traditionally, this piece has been conducted by the orchestra conductor at our concerts because Renee and I would be out in the aisles conducting our choirs in a fun little set of carols. But we were away from the stage, and then Silent Night was where we would process the choirs back up. And then by verse 3, everybody was up there, and then the audience stands up. And it's this moment, I get goosebumps even just thinking about it. And it was Renee's last Christmas concert in 2019, and my colleague Kevin Suderland, totally classy move, he insisted that Renee come back up to the podium and conduct that one last time, and it was – I find myself inhaling again through that because it was not lost on the audience at Orchestra Hall what the significance was of that. They knew that was his last Christmas concert, and it was, he was being celebrated all night long. In fact, it was – the first time I think that he ever took a bow after Christmas concerts were at those Christmas concerts in 2019. But to see everybody stand up and you can hear it. I mean, it does those. That was a live recording and the choirs were mic'd. But when you're in the room, you can feel that there are now 2,000 people singing, like I said, singing from their feet and just going full throttle. And every soprano alumni who's out in the audience is joining the sopranos on the desk hand. So you get to this huge, loud, dramatic chord in the sopranos.
Breaking glass.
Oh, my gosh. You know, we would love a new concert hall at Concordia one of these years. And I think one of the ways we'll do it is if everybody sings Silent Night loud enough on verse 3, we could break it once and for all. You know, but so it's really quite special. And there's even something about from the front of the room where I'm at, and I'm looking out at the audience to see this, you know, it's almost like a sporting event where they do the wave and you see the people standing and in kind of a staggered way where the people up front, they know it's time to stand. By golly, we're going to lead the way. And they stand up. And then almost in a wave-like fashion, it goes all the way back and up the bleachers and people are standing up there. And they're standing for one reason, and that is to join together in a community of singing of this piece, which I think is probably maybe the definitive Christmas carol. I mean, it brings us to that most intimate moment in the Christmas narrative, and there are 2,000 people standing to join that community of song together. And they get, I would think in many cases, they get emotional singing that too and feel the goosebumps, and they love. So this reminds me very much that it's one of the things I try to do at the Christmas concert and that we've tried to do for decades. You know, this year's concert's the 97th annual. And so it works on many levels for our audience members because I think that they love that they can come, they see the visual art of the mural that Paul Johnson does beautifully on every year, but they get to sing with us. We don't just make them sit in the seats for an hour and a half, but they get to stand with us at pivotal moments in the concert. They get to, as the banners, the Christmas banners are processing, they're standing and singing with us on the processional hymn and carol. And they're standing with us on the recessional as the choirs are leaving and surrounding them for what I've always called the benediction moment, where we sing one or two more pieces kind of surrounding the audience to bring the concert to more of a genteel conclusion. And so it's That's a very special moment, and I think it harkens back, too, to what we were talking about earlier with that Lutheran liberal arts tradition, the church relationship of the college, and our ability to unabashedly stand and sing songs of the season from the religious aspect of it. And it's a great joy. It's one of the most rewarding corners of my work right now at Concordia College mm-hmm. and throughout the community. And it's a really great honor to be able to design a concert that I hope will mean a lot to people because they connect with the story and they connect with the music.
We're visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton, the Director of Choral Activities at Concordia College. And, Michael, you were talking about that version of Silent Night being arranged by Renee Clausen. Mm-hmm. And then a different conductor would have a slightly different take mm-hmm. on a song. What do you think most people don't understand about what directors and conductors bring to a piece of music?
Tell you, this is kind of fun. I have family members who have asked me before, why do they need you? Why do they? And honestly, the truth is, by the time we get to a concert, I hope that I'm reminding people of the things that we've been learning for the last 2 months as we mm-hmm. prepare for this concert. So in a concert situation, I don't always feel like I have to have the largest, grandest gesture to tell them how to sing it. We've talked for 2 months on how do we want to present this piece of music. So the fun thing for me, the thing that I enjoy the most about being a choral conductor, I love the performances, don't get me wrong, and I love that we can share the product that we've been working on. But for me, the best part about it is the rehearsals that we do. The Concordia Choir is in rehearsal every day, Monday through Friday, from 4:30 to 6 o'clock. The students grant us the ability to work, grant me the ability to work with them for 90 minutes a day. They're just committed to the art, and they know that deep down they need to be a part of the choir. And all of the singers and all of the players and instrumentalists do that with us at Concordia. But for 90 minutes a day, we get to craft what we're eventually going to share with an audience. And I love the teaching part of that a great deal. So for different conductors, we might find different interpretations. We might do different speeds or tempi of a piece of music. We might find different high points to draw out or cute little nuances that bring a little sparkle to a bit of text here or there throughout the piece of music. And the truth that I always think, and I like to tell my students this, is it's particularly enjoyable if you never do one piece of music identically every single time you do it. But you try and find, tonight I'm going to bring out this, or we're going to do it a little bit slower here.
Yeah. Let's talk about that because you're telling the story of the birth of Christ, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which – I mean, don't they call this the oldest story ever told?
The greatest story ever told.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
But it is one of the older.
It's, you know, more or less 2,023
yes.
years old,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So how do you – what's your process for the tradition, but also let's not just do the same concert every year?
Right. So I always love to make sure that first and foremost we have pieces on the program that are going to connect with the audience at one level emotionally that will hearken them back to when they were singing in the choirs or when they had sung a piece. And then I'm also looking, though, for music that will be new to our listeners that might introduce them to new composers or new styles of music. So it's been fun for us this year. We have two pieces that will be sung for the choir and the orchestra together and the audience, actually, that are brand new arrangements done by 2023 graduates of Concordia, Jared Campbell and Carmen Geiger-Schutz, two brand new Concordia Cabra alumni. And this summer I talked to them both and asked them if they would like to orchestrate a piece for the Christmas concert. And so both of them have arranged a piece of music. Jared Campbell arranged the processional hymn, and Carmen did a new arrangement of Joy to the World that the audience will join with us on singing as the choirs are all leaving the space. So I really love getting our students involved like that, and this will be kind of a brand new, first time to my knowledge, that we've had student compositions for the choir and the orchestra at the Christmas concert. But they're talented, and why shouldn't we do that? So it's a balance, but I'm also thinking, well, we can't stay in a slow tempo for too long. We've got to make sure we've got some up-tempo. Oh, yeah, the room is dark. You know, the lighting is interesting.
Right,
but
yeah.
If you stay at slow tempo for 20 minutes, you're going to hear some light snoring from the bleachers.
Concordia is, like many colleges, a bit of an international experience. You sent along a Spanish language song. Quickly introduce this, and then we'll hear this one.
Great. There's a Spanish Christmas carol called Alegría, or Carol of Joy. And we have a lovely, fantastic arrangement of in our library at Concordia that probably has not been done for decades and decades, and my guess is maybe 40 to 50 years. Hmm. But I did want to make sure that we were introducing an international flavor to the concert, too. We do carols from all around the world, but this Spanish tune really resonated with me right now. This is the theme of this year's concert is Rejoice and Sing. So it's kind of an uplifting and up-tempo kind of a concert. And so I thought this would be a perfect concert to do Carol of Joy or Alegría in. And the one thing about the arrangement is that it was all in English. And so I asked one of my students who studied abroad in Spain last semester to help us find the Spanish translation for the refrain. So every time we get to the refrain, we'll sing the refrain with a Spanish text instead of the English translation of it. And so we're kind of mixing the English lyrics with the traditional Spanish refrain for Alegría. That's great. That's fantastic. And what I love about that tune is, so that is centuries old tune. You can find recordings like that one with some more contemporary instrumentation and percussion. There's a wonderful YouTube that my student and I found. He shared it with me, actually, of more authentic centuries old instruments and take on the rhythms and that kind of thing. But what's fun for us, too, on this particular piece is, we'll have castanets, we'll have finger cymbals, triangles. There'll be percussion with it to give it a little bit of that authentic flavor that I think it would be performed as in Spain or in Mexico if you were to hear it there. So it's a fun opportunity for us. And we've done music in the last several years from several different continents, a Nigerian-influenced piece last year called Ogo Nifun Oluwa, and before that year, another Kenyan-inspired piece called Keresi Mesi Odundeo, and with percussion on that one as well. So definitely an important aspect of the Concordia experience is how we can connect with the world. We travel the world both physically and metaphorically through all of the music that we select, and Christmas can be one of those same times of the year where we do that same thing.
Do you have a favorite?
Oh, mercy. Well,
that really made me want to find an Elvis Christmas. Or a Sawyer Brown, actually.
Do I have a favorite Christmas tune? Oh, man, no. I don't think I do have a favorite. If I were to try and nail down my favorites, that would just take me years and years and years. I think the truth is I tend to just love the music that I'm teaching in the moment and with the students so intensely. The one thing I'll say is I won't program something that I really don't enjoy, that I don't like, and there's kind of a made-up mathematical equation in my brain like, you know, if only 10% of an audience is going to love this piece, we probably shouldn't do that piece of music. And so to think about a favorite tune, you know, I love O Holy Night. I resonate with that. I love Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And there are such great arrangements of these tunes. But, you know, and then on the other hand, I love listening to the Linda Ronstadt Christmas CD or the Pentatonics Christmas CD. You know, it's people might be surprised how eclectic our collection of music is on the playlists at our house at Christmas time. You know, Dolly Parton has that Christmas tune that my wife puts on repeat over and over and over, and I can't remember the name of it because, well, it hasn't started just yet this year. But, you know, favorites are hard to come by, but the songs from the Christmas season that I love can be cataloged by the hundreds.
Dr. Michael Culleton, he is an associate professor of music at Concordia College, where he is also the director of choral activities and conductor of the Concordia Choir. The big Concordia Christmas concert is happening in Moorhead Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and there will also be a one-hour video version available later. All details are at concordiachristmas.com. Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding number 3 is about sharing and generosity. It states, Native people have rich traditions of sharing and generosity, which include gifting, shared meals, powwow gatherings, shared living spaces, and care for relatives, including the environment, natural resources, and waters.
In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Mark Bluestone, enrolled member of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation, discuss the importance of feeding people.
Now, there's other things that we emulate a lot of things from culture as well. I mean, when we do, we feed people. We are big on feeding at any event that we do. You know, when we have staff kind of activities, we say prayers before we start our meal. There's a reason for that. It's what we do in our community. Now, it's a little bit different because of church and state separation when you're dealing with kids. But when we have staff in services, there's also a hierarchy even when they eat, you know. In this community, veterans eat first, and there is a hierarchy. Our staff knows that. I mean, and we don't have to remind them, you know, in this district, it's veterans, it's elders, it's community service people as our next set. And so we include our Legion Auxiliary people in there, but also our firefighters, our ambulance folks. They get to eat first, and there's been, as far as I could tell, and maybe there has been, but I haven't heard any complaints. You know, we've been doing this for 10 years. It's interesting to watch that we provide our budget for food service, where whatever activity we have, we share food. You know, last night at parent-teacher conferences, we shared a meal. We had a family math night a couple weeks at the elementary school. We had food there. You know, that's just who we are. And then that thought process extends to, you know, everything that we try and do is at least culturally relevant for here. And we're hoping that as the kids learn those kind of things, that they understand that when they go other places and understand, oh, they're providing a meal. So, no, veterans got to go first. Elders got to go first. Then I'll get my chance to do that. And so we're emulating that on a regular basis.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Back tomorrow telling more of North Dakota's story. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.